Welcome to Journeys to Orthodoxy, a production of the Icon New Media Network, where Orthodox Christianity is the future of American spirituality. Journeys to Orthodoxy can be heard on the Orthodox Christian Network at www.myocn.net. I'm your host, Jacob Lee.
This week on Journeys, Father James interviews the very Reverend Father Matthew McKay.
Welcome to Journeys to Orthodoxy. This is Father James Early, guest hosting for Jacob Lee. Today, I have a very special guest again with me. I'm speaking with my own personal spiritual father, my pastor, the man I work for, and a good friend of mine, Father Matthew McKay, the pastor of St. Joseph Antioch Orthodox Church in Houston, Texas. How you doing, Father?
Howdy.
Father Matthew has a very interesting pilgrimage into Orthodoxy, and he's going to be talking about it today. So, Father, let's go ahead and start at the beginning. Always a good place to start. Tell me, what was your upbringing like? Religiously, what kind of home did you grow up in? Catholic, Protestant, Jewish, what was it?
Okay. When I grew up in California and Georgia, mostly Georgia when I turned 10, is that we were typical Protestants. We went to church every week. If we didn't go to church, then we had a family Bible study that my dad would lead, and we would read out of the Bible, and my dad would then expound extemporaneously for about 2 or 3 minutes about what he thought it meant. And we were usually in the Presbyterian Church or the Methodist Church. The reason we were in the Presbyterian Church is my grandfather was a Presbyterian minister in Michigan, and so my dad grew up with that. My mother came out of a Methodist background, so if we couldn't find a Presbyterian church, we'd go to the Methodist Church. And then when I was a teenager, Protestant churches were competing with each other with large youth groups, and so it would fall to the Methodists versus the Baptists, and we'd go back and forth to different mm-hmm. churches to seeing who had the bigger and best youth group at the time. And so I spent a lot of times with the Baptists, I spent a lot of times with Methodists, and sometime also with the Presbyterians. But all of these were very good. I learned scripture. I learned a sense of community. But I always felt like there must be something else. And the other thing I noticed is that even as a teenager is that these different groups, Presbyterian, Methodist, and Baptist, they weren't all saying the same things. And they were kind of conflicted in how they were going about doing their ministry, but also how they presented Christ, and also their notion about the church and even the church's polity. I remember learning about that early on also. So when I went to college, and I went to college in Citadel, which is in South Carolina, in Charleston, and there was a lot of churches fairly close to school, and so I could visit, so I decided I would conduct interviews. So I called up some local pastors, and I basically said, so what do you believe, and then how do you do that? And then I would go visit the churches on Sunday. And so, again, the three churches I went to the most were, of course, the Presbyterian Church, Methodist Church, and then also the Baptist Church. And some of them are very, they're all very nice people and all. But I thought, geez, there must be something else. And then I asked a friend of mine, who went to this very small, obscure chapel on campus, which means you didn't have to leave, so that was that saved you some time there. And their services in the evening, that means you got the whole morning off. And he was going to a group of Christians I had never heard of before. They were called Episcopalians. I didn't know what they believed. I didn't know what they were.
Wait a minute.
I didn't know where they came from.
Time out. You never heard of Episcopalians?
No, I hadn't.
Through high school?
Never. No, when I was a kid, nothing.
That is amazing.
Yeah. I remember that they were probably around once I kind of thought about, after I met the Episcopalians. But, they were never on the radar as far as even a viable option or who they were. And when I went to their service, I was amazed that they had a real worship service that actually kind of made sense. It was my first experience with liturgical worship. And it had a beginning, a middle, and an ending, and it was done very, very well. And that kind of spoke to me. And then I also was hearing the scripture incorporated into worship service in a way I'd never had before. You'd have a lectionary where you had chunks of scripture read, and they would tie together, and it kind of made sense. And I like that. And but that whole understanding of a real sense of worship, which I'd never seen or experienced before, was something new, and it really attracted me. Was that, geez, these guys are worshiping. And then I studied a little bit about the Episcopal Church from what I could gather. And, you know, they were saying things like, you know, we practice ancient Christianity, and the early church was all about communion, and they had formalized worship services. And so, you know, that was the first time I ever heard that. And so that impressed me, and I got involved with the Episcopal Church that way while I was in college. I couldn't go to the Roman Catholic Church, and my mother was going to disown me. So
I understand. So what
even though this one looked very much like them, but it uh-huh. you know, it was.
So what kind of Episcopal Church was it? Low church, high church, middle?
Well, because it was in the South, it was. I guess the term would have been broad or low, but okay. I didn't know any difference.
Right.
I didn't know any
okay.
difference. When I joined the Marine Corps after college, I was stationed in California, and there I checked out some Episcopal churches, and the one church, St. Michael's in Carlsbad, that I really liked, that was considered a high church, and
okay.
I didn't, and so their liturgical practices had a little more depth and more body to them mm-hmm. than what I'd seen before, and they were a very friendly group, and they were also you know, trying to be as faithful to the ancient Christianity as they understood it, as they could be. And so I liked that, and I got involved with the youth ministry there and the acolyte program and things like that. So I did that, and then I got married, met my wonderful wife there. Not there, but we got married, and so we were in the Episcopal Church and in the Marine Corps at the same time for about a year. And then I went to seminary.
Tell me about your calling to the priesthood, if you would.
When I was growing up as a kid, I remember at certain points of time, you know, it would be, so what do you think you really want to do? And I didn't tell very many people this, but I kept thinking, you know, I'm thinking maybe I want to be a minister of some sort.
Mm.
And that's why I think it was important for me in college to, quote, do these interviews. I also looked up stuff in college and at the library, too. I read up about these different churches and things. And that kind of informed me about where they were coming from and what either I liked about them or I didn't. And so that call was always there. In fact, even when I went to college, I got a degree in education / biology,
mm-hmm.
Knowing or thinking that an education degree would probably be helpful in the ministry business if I ever needed to fall back on that, if the Marine Corps thing didn't work out.
Right.
So I did that, and because I was so involved in this church in Carlsbad, California, I then went to seminary. They recommended me. We had a new bishop who just happened to come from Alabama, and I could talk Southern because I'd grown up in Georgia. And so when I met him, I put on my best Southern hat, and I went and spoke to him, and he said, "Well, my, this is wonderful. You're from the South." He said, "I think I'm going to send you to Suwannee," which is a seminary in Tennessee, and it's fairly remote. It's on what's called Mont Eagle. It's on a mountain, and it's in the middle of the woods, and the buildings look like they kind of dropped out of the sky from England, because there are all these big stone structures. Mm. And that was an interesting experience to be able to go to seminary there. It looked very traditional. It had this very, very Anglo-Catholic look to it. And some of their services were actually very high church services, but they were riddled through full of
Protestant liberalism. And that's when I got my first smack in the face that not all Episcopal churches were actually the same, and not everybody was on the same page. And in fact, the church I had come from was a minority position.
Uh-huh. So your parish in California was pretty traditional, conservative.
They were a high church, and they were conservative, and that's not what Swanee was. Swanee could put on a good liturgical show, but they were crazy as loons as far as everything else was going on. Well, they had clown ministry. I remember that. That really was unimpressive. What? And then,
sounds like the Baptist church.
Yeah, well, it just got sillier and sillier. I remember that. And then we had some, we had a couple of rank heretics teaching us, which was interesting.
What did they teach? What kind of stuff did they say?
Well, it was all the rage. It was pro women sliding into pro homosexual stuff. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It was Jesus Christ is not the way, the truth, the light, but a way, a truth,
a truth and a life.
Yeah, he was just one of many other. You know, and that's when I first got this notion of, oh, we're all on different buses going to the same place, kind of mentality. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And while I was there, and I did have some very good professors, and I did have some very good experiences there. A couple of I studied a lot of the ancient church liturgically, historically, and also theologically. I did a lot of patristic studies, and that was my own choice. And I was free to do that, and I learned lots of things. I remember one of my professors, after we had met, and I'd written a paper about the early church and stuff, he looked at me and he said, I can tell you're not long for this world. Meaning I wouldn't be in the Episcopal Church very long. I didn't know what he was talking about. But while I had a brief moment of respite in seminary, I remember I saw a book in the bookstore that it was just one copy and it was all by itself. It was kind of like these neon spiritual arrows were pointing at it and said, The Orthodox Church by Timothy Ware.
Danger.
Yeah, I grabbed that book and I read it and I was hooked. I thought, oh my gosh, these guys had it right. We keep trying to reinvent the wheel and we're not doing a very good job. And so when I read that book, I knew what I was looking for. I just didn't know where it was. I continued in my studies in seminary, and just before I left seminary, I'd heard about a group of Protestants that had converted. I don't even know how I heard about it.
To Orthodoxy.
And so I thought, boy, that's amazing. I'd love to talk to this guy. So just before I left seminary, I wrote to the publishing house that you could buy Orthodox books from, it was Light and Life at that time, and the only free thing they ever gave me was an old Again magazine. And in it, they talked about how they were a group of Protestants who had converted. And so I thanked Light and Life, and I took that magazine and packed up all our stuff. We moved to sunny Southern California to the Carlsbad area, and I got to go back to the church that actually sent me to seminary. And While I was ordained to a deacon there, the priest there told me, he said, you're not ordained yet. I don't want you to come into the services as a layman. He said, so go visit wherever you want to go. And so I looked in the phone book, and there was an Orthodox church around the corner. And it was in the next town over. And so my wife and I went there, and it was the first time we had seen an Orthodox church in English. When I was in seminary, we had visited two Greek churches, and in fact, that was a memorable experience because after one of the liturgies, I went to coffee hour, and I stood by myself for 30 minutes with a donut in one hand and a cup of coffee in another hand. And after I'd finished sipping my coffee for 30 minutes and finally eating my donut, I started to leave, and a little Greek lady came up to me, and she said, are you Greek? I said, no, I'm not. And she said, why are you here?
Oh, Lord have mercy.
I said, I don't know, something about Jesus and God and the church.
Strange.
So Anyways, but when I got to California, we went and visited this Orthodox church. The liturgy was beautiful. Like we could, my wife and I could both understand it. I told her I liked the Orthodox church, even though I was going to be ordained the next week as a deacon in the Episcopal church. And as soon as the liturgy was over with, all of a sudden, everybody hit the deck on their knees, and we started these horrendously long prayers.
Oh, boy.
We decided to visit them on a kneeling Pentecost Sunday.
Oh, boy.
So, halfway through that service, my wife looks over to me. She said, "If you think we're doing this every week, you're crazy."
Yeah, you had no way of knowing that this wasn't...
I had no
every
idea.
Week.
Didn't know, yeah. I said, "Well, I've never seen this before. Boy, these people are really stout and pious." You know, we were on our knees for a whole hour or plus after the liturgy. So, and then they told us later that wasn't in every... We had just hit the right Sunday.
You got twice the service.
Yeah,
for
I'm
money.
Not really sure if that was the right Sunday, but that was the Sunday we went. Anyway, so then I heard about, after I was ordained in the Episcopal Church and I worked in this... Episcopal Church in California, the priest I worked for is a really good man, kind man, and he was concerned about the direction of the Episcopal Church like I was and like some other people were. And so I told him, I said, I had been studying things on the side about the Orthodox Church. He said, "Well, tell me what you've learned." And so I did. He said, "Let's incorporate that in our Sunday school program." So we did. And he said, "Let's incorporate some of that into our own catechism program here." So we did. And then I told him, I said, "They're going to have a conference up in Santa Barbara," which is only about an hour, hour and a half away. And he said, "Go." And so my pregnant wife and I went up to the very first Mission Evangelist Conference in Santa Barbara. Mm-hmm. And we met a whole host of people. We met Father Peter Gilquist, Father Gordon. We met Father John Morris, who actually, much later on, God had big plans for us. He became my sponsor at my ordination to the priesthood many, 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 many moons later.
Interesting.
But, yeah. So we met all these people. We had a wonderful time. I remember the night before liturgy, Father Peter Gilquist stood up and said, "Let's practice the Trisagion since we're going to have liturgy tomorrow." And so everybody in the place started singing "Holy God, Holy Mighty." And I started singing also. And my wife looked at me and she said, "How do you know these words?" I said, "I have no idea. They're not hard words, but I was just singing along." And so I thought, to quote a phrase I heard in seminary, "I'm really not long for that world."
Oh, no.
That was kind of like my spooky Jesus moment. And So we did that for about 3 years, and the Episcopal Church, from my estimation, was getting crazier and crazier. And I thought, well, you know, there were groups that were raising up. In fact, in the diocese I was in Southern California, there was actually talk about, are we going to go to Rome? Are we going to go and become our own continuing Anglican group? And there was a small percentage of us that were saying, well, we ought to look at the Orthodox Church. And so, you know, with that being said, and with all of the commotion and all the craziness that kept coming out of, and the changing craziness, you know, that was the other thing that bothered me about the Protestant Church in general, but also the Episcopal Church, is that things kept changing. It's like the goalposts kept moving.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what was good and pious and solid 10 years ago became irrelevant and needed to change in the next 10 years. And so
if I can ask you,
sure.
did you have faddy things, trendy things that would,
I would think clown ministry is faddy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I know. Goofy posters and, you know, all that kind of jazz that I saw in seminary and also what I experienced. You know, I remember when I was a kid with the Methodist Church, the local youth minister there was trying to get us introduce us to the concept that communion was important. So we went to a youth meeting, and after the youth meeting, he had communion at the back door, and it was hamburger buns and Coca-Cola.
Oh.
So, Lord, I guess if we'd really been Southern, it'd been moon pies and Coke.
Well, you should have had barbecue, you know, if you're going to be Southern.
That was, yeah.
Okay,
he was struggling. But
my goodness. So, okay, you're you're still on staff at the Episcopal Church.
Yeah, and
the
then
conservative
I
one.
And I, yeah, and
you're
I
looking
thought,
around, you think Orthodoxy may be the real deal, huh?
Yeah. Well, and I also thought, well, I thought the Episcopal Church was probably going to start to implode. I was just about 30 years ahead of.
Yeah, ahead of the curve.
Of the curve.
That's funny.
But I thought, okay, this place is going to fall apart. This is going to, you know, we're going to have to pick sides. And I thought, oh, I'll be sneaky. And so, don't ever be sneaky with God because he'll get you back. And so what I said, oh, I like the Marine Corps. I think I'll be a chaplain and wait this fight out. And when the dust settles, I'll just pick the right side after there's blood on the floor. And so I called up a friend who was a chaplain. And sure enough, within 30 days, boom, the Navy picked me up and said, this is great. You used to be in a military. You can speak Marine fluently. We're going to send you to Japan. And now you're going to be a chaplain in Japan for 3 years.
So you're going to get a four-year vacation paid for by Uncle Sam.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was actually three. And and so there I was. And so the way God got back at me is I thought, well, I'm an Episcopalian. I can do high church things and all that. Well, that's not the way the chaplain program works in the military. You're either a Protestant, Roman Catholic, or other. And I was I was Protestant. I wasn't other. So that meant I had to do, for me when I was in Japan, Sunday consisted of doing a liturgical service, communion, where Episcopalians and Lutherans would come together.
Mm-hmm.
Then I would take a 30-minute break, and then I would go do a vanilla Protestant service,
uh-huh.
which was to, you know, kind of like Presbo Methodist light.
Presbo Methodist light.
And then I would take another 30-minute break, and then Crazyville broke out. I would have to be part of a gospel service. I had never seen one of them before.
Full gospel?
Full gospel.
Oh, boy.
And we'd be singing and jumping around and dancing, and I'm like, oh, man, joke's on me. I had to do that for 3 years. I would come home every Sunday with a raging headache.
Oh, man.
And I knew God was going, yeah, you thought you'd do this. You thought this would be easy. So after 3 years of that, then I got transferred to Norfolk, Virginia, and I was on an aircraft carrier. And then I liked the carrier. Was fun. It was exciting. But while we were, in fact, we were out one day doing a workup. So we were just supposed to be gone for a week or two. And all of a sudden we got a call that Saddam Hussein was doing not nice things in Iraq.
Mm.
So we had to do a big left turn in the ocean, and we went screaming towards the Middle East. And
so this is like 1990 or something like
that? Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, I remember.
Yeah,
remember
and
that
so
happened.
We had to, we went screaming across the ocean.
August of 90, yeah.
And then we got hit the Azores. It was like, oh, just kidding. So then we went all the way back, and then we came back to port, and that was pretty wild. But only did that for about a year, and because then at that point there was a drawdown, and I was getting out of the Navy, and I thought, you know. And I talked to my wife. I said, Lynn, I said, I don't want to raise our kids. We had two boys, Patrick and Sean. I did not want to raise them in the Episcopal Church. Things were just getting nuts. And it was the sexuality stuff was really getting perverse and weird and almost militant. So I thought, you know, I'm just going to leave. I know I'm not going to make a big stink. I'm not going to say anything ugly. I'm just going to say thanks. It's been real. It's time for me to go. And so that's what I did. And I had been in contact with Father Peter Gilquist my entire time in the chaplaincy. So he said, oh, there's a new mission in Virginia. So you know, we got introduced in that mission. And that's actually where it was really odd. 1 week I was Episcopalian chaplain, and then I had to be really careful about ending my Episcopalian career and ending the Navy career, and then boom, immediately getting chrismated in the Orthodox Church. And so there was this kind of wonky week or two there where I was like neither fish nor fowl. It was kind of odd.
So they didn't put you through a catechumen?
Oh yeah, I mean,
oh, okay.
Actually, I had studied so much, and I'd been doing the St. Stephen's course while I was in the Navy.
Oh, while you were in the Navy?
Yeah,
okay.
I did it while I was in the Navy. I knew as much or more than the priest. I was. That's okay. I would ask him questions. I could tell he didn't know the answer because he hadn't even read that stuff before. So then I would kind of explain it to him. But anyways, That's a whole other story. But then from there, when that was when I was finally out of the Navy, I was then told again that there was a mission starting out and that I needed to, because I was an ex-Episcopalian, I needed to go up to Wisconsin. That's where Father Bill Olhausen was. Mm-hmm. And so we went up there for about a year, year and a half. And I was a chaplain in the hospital there. I did a CPE program, and that was a lot of fun and very interesting. Not particularly CPE. Well, that really was, but that's a whole other story. But being up there with Father Bill Olhausen and that congregation, they were kind of a unique congregation. There was this huge Serbian population in town. They didn't mix it up with us. Mm-hmm. Poor people didn't have any vowels for their names. So when I would have to look up names of people to go visit and things like that.
It's things like Jinjic.
It was just a bunch of letters. Yeah, you were kind of throwing vowels in. But that was my first experience with Cradle Orthodox up close and personal. Mm-hmm. And they're Serbians, because I would be a chaplain and we would start talking, and then they would say, you know, I remember this one lady, we were talking, and she said, "So, what country do you come from?" And I said, "Well, I'm American." She goes, "No, your people." I said, "Oh," I said, "they came from Scotland years ago." She goes, "You mean there's an Orthodox church in Scotland?" And I said, I smiled, I said, "I'm sure there's one." to this day, I don't know that there is.
Started by Russian.
I'm sure there was at least one. So that satisfied her that I was really Orthodox, because they came from some Orthodox country like Scotland.
Yeah. Well, it used to be.
Yeah, yeah. So from there, that's when I got a phone call from Bishop Pontoon. He said, you know, he has this very, very warm way of speaking.
Yes,
it's very direct. He said, "You're going to get ordained. You're going to be ordained in California." I said, "Oh, that's great. Where?" He said, "Either San Francisco or Los Angeles." And I said, "Oh, they're so close."
Which one?
I said, "Give me a break here." And I didn't say it. So I was kind of concerned, and he got frustrated because I wanted to know which one. And so he finally turned me over to Kathy, and it's Kathy in the archdiocesan office. She was really sweet, and she said, "I'll take care of it for you." So she called me back in 30 minutes, and she said, "Okay, they narrowed it down. It's going to be in San Francisco." And I just happened to have a brother-in-law that lived there, so that was good. So we raised the money at Father Bill's church to buy me a plane ticket, and bought for myself, because we didn't have enough money for the whole family, so it's just me. And I went out to California to be ordained in a church I'd never seen before in San Francisco, and sleep on my brother-in-law's couch. And that worked out real well. That's kind of a wild story, because when I got to the church there, I knocked on the door. I was told, "Show up at this church, you know, take your vestments there, all your black shirt and all that jazz, you know." So I did. I knocked on the door, and the priest opens the door. I said, "Hi, I'm..." And he goes, "I hate guys like you." I said, "What?" He goes, "This is a big weekend. The bishop's coming, and you just show up, and now we have to do an ordination." I thought, "Well, with thy spirit." And then his deacon showed up. He goes, "Don't mind him. He's really stressed out. The bishop's coming." He said, "I'll tell you where to stand and where to go." So that worked out real well. And they took me to the dinners and things like that, and my head was spinning. I didn't know what to do, and I'd watched a film about a man being ordained. I watched his ordination over and over again, so I knew what the service looked like. I'd never seen an ordination before, and I wanted to know what was coming. And so and it's a good thing I did that, because the only reason I knew what was going on in the service is I knew the melodies. Because everything else, though, was in Arabic. So
okay.
That was my first experience in an all-Arabic parish. And that got kind of humorous after I got ordained. When I got ordained, these two priests from the Middle East who were visiting came and got me. And they stuck their hands in my collar, and they twisted it, so I was choking. And I thought, "Well, this is..." I'm like, "Guys, I'm trying to breathe here." And they... They didn't care. They drug me in the altar, and every time I'd go to kiss the altar, they, like, bounced my head off the altar. So I was liturgically hazed, and then Bishop Antoon said the prayers on my head, which I didn't understand. I don't know if it was his accent or he was... I know he doesn't have an accent, but I heard one. Or he was speaking in Arabic, either one. And so then I was... Boom, I'm ordained. And it's when I first... I learned my first Arabic word from Bishop Antoon. The priests were doing something he didn't like, and Bishop Antoon turned to them, and he made a sound. He went... and he made them stop. My eyes got big. He goes, "It's okay, dear." And he said, "Can you chant?" I said, "Yes, I think so." And he goes, "Well, you need to go out and do these petitions." So I went out to do my petitions. I'm out there again and again.
I'm guessing you didn't do it in Arabic.
No, I did it in English again and again. Dead silence in this church. You could have heard a pin drop. And about that time, Bishop Antoon starts screaming at the priest. He goes, "Don't they know? Have Lord have mercy! Tell them, Lord have mercy!" So the priest leans over the altar and looks up towards the choir loft up in the back, and he goes, "Lord have mercy! Lord have mercy!" One voice comes from the choir. It's more of a question than a response. It's, "Lord have mercy." So I go do that. I do the next petition, and then you hear. Two voices asked the question, "Lord, have mercy." I did a third petition, and then like three or four of them tried to throw a melody behind it. Then Bishop Antoon turns to the other deacon and he says, "Get him out of there." That was the end of my liturgical experience from my ordination as deacon in San Francisco. My wife called me that night, and she said, "So... are you ordained? What is it like?" I said, "I think I'm ordained. They keep calling me deacon." I said, "I didn't understand a word of anything."
So, oh, mercy.
Yeah. So we were up in Milwaukee for about four more months. I was the deacon there. And then I was told that there was a conference down in Chicago. I was going to get ordained a priest because they wanted me to do some mission work, which is fine, you know. I was ordained it's funny, my ordination certificate says St. George and Cicero, or St. Mary's and Cicero, I can't remember. Mm-hmm. See, I don't remember because I've never been there. I was ordained in St. Hilton.
They don't do those anymore,
and I'm kind of glad for that. But anyways, from there, then I got a phone call from... Father Joseph Shada in Houston, Texas.
And he was the...
he's the dean.
And he was also the pastor of St. George.
George, right. And he said, "I understand you're ready to do some mission work." I said, "Well, yes." And he said, "I have a brand new mission down here in Houston. I'd like you to come down and look at it." And so he said, "Could you and your wife come down?" I said, "Yes." And so we flew on down, and our boys stayed with a nice little Greek family. And... we came down, looked around. Things looked good, and the congregation said they liked me. And I remember Father Joseph said, "Okay, you're going to do Vespers Saturday night," and I did. And he said, "And you're going to do Orthros and Liturgy on Sunday," which I did. And
was that at St. George?
No. It was in a rented space.
Okay.
They already rented a space. And they had just moved into it, and so I was doing service there. And in fact, they were being ministered to by a Deacon Thomas who would eventually become Bishop Thomas.
Yes.
And so he would run from St. George, from St. George, their liturgy, run to the mission, and he would be putting his vestments on as he jumped out of the car and as they would walk in, and then he would do Deacon's typical with communion from St. George. And so when I was there, it was like the first or second liturgy they'd ever had in their space.
So at one point you were a priest when Bishop Thomas was Deacon Thomas.
Well, no, he actually, when I came down to visit, I think maybe he still was a deacon there, or he was just made a priest.
Okay.
Right. Just made a priest. He and I are off by a couple months, but he's a bishop and I'm not, so we're really miles apart.
Yeah.
So we started this mission, and when I came back down here, and a month later, the family moved. We packed up all our stuff. We moved. We came here. The truck died the minute we got to Houston, so we knew we needed to be here.
we have received a sign.
Yeah. The truck's not moving. You're here. And I haven't moved since. We started off with 17 families. At about the 3.5-year mark, we were up to about 30, 32 families. We were able to purchase some land and build our first building. After we were in that building for, I want to say, like 7.
You're talking about what's now the hall?
Yeah, I think of 7 years. We were 6 or 7 years, yeah, because that was about the 10-year mark. Then we'd also built our temple.
The permanent
At the 10-year mark. Mm-hmm. And this year we'll have been in our temple 5 years. Mm-hmm. That service when we consecrated the temple was one of the longest services I've ever been at. It was like 4.5
sure
hours,
was,
five
yeah.
hours of again and again, because we did, as you recall.
I was a deacon at the time, I remember.
Yeah, we did. And we had an ordination on top of a consecration.
We had all kinds of stuff.
On top of
you were raised
an elevation, on top of a hierarchical liturgy. I remember Bishop Basil, when he got done, he took his crown off. He said, "Where's the car? I'm leaving." he was exhausted.
Can I take you back a little? I'd like to ask about your wife, Korea Lynn. How much of a struggle did she have making the transition? Now, she's from a Roman Catholic background, is that right?
Yeah, she grew up Roman Catholic, went to Roman Catholic high school all throughout her, so she went grade 1 to 12 as a Roman Catholic student. They went mass every single week and all that, so they were, mm-hmm. They were very faithful, a Roman Catholic family.
I remember you said her first experience with Orthodox worship was not that positive.
No.
Pentecost.
No, she thought I was nuts.
Extra long liturgy with New.
Well, and she also, when I was in seminary, she and I visited two Greek churches.
That's
there.
True. Yeah, and that wasn't real positive.
Yeah. Well, the one Greek church didn't invite us to coffee hour. I was like, okay, you've seen the liturgy, go ahead and leave. And then they went to coffee hour. And the other one, that I went to coffee hour, they wondered why I was there.
Are you Greek? Yeah.
But. She was really good about it, and I knew everything was timing. That's why when I met in California, Father Peter Gilchrist and those in the gang at the Parish Life Conference in Santa Barbara, it took another 7 years before we came into the Orthodox Church.
Right. Okay.
And timing's everything. The wife needed to be assured that it was sane and mm-hmm. the place where we needed to be, and so I would keep her informed of what I was reading, and then I would hand her things to look at, and she would go, yeah, that sounds right, yeah, that sounds good.
Oh, yeah.
And then I would explain, then I would show her the craziness in the Episcopal Church, and she would go, yeah, it's insane. Mm-hmm. We need to leave. And so it was a mutual decision, but it took a while. I think that worked out all right.
Again, going back, but what did your parents think about you becoming Orthodox?
Oh, well,
because they had been staunch Protestants.
Yeah, yeah,
Bible.
I got them to go to the Episcopal Church, and they joined the Episcopal Church right after I did
when
I was in college, and so they had become very, very faithful in the Episcopal Church, and they had started a mission or were going to start a mission in where they lived up in North Georgia, and. I remember my dad telling me that their pastor was leaving and they needed to get a new one, and so the one thing they asked their bishop at that point, they said, "We'll take anybody you got. Please don't send us a gal." And so that's exactly who he did send, which then divided the congregation up, and
almost as if to spite them.
Who knows? But. I thought, and that was just about the time we were converting, and my folks were bemoaning the fact that the church was split. They didn't like the Episcopal Church. It was going in a direction they didn't like. And I thought, well, here's a softball. I'll lob this right over the plate and knock a homer. And so I said, "Funny you should say that. We're leaving." Boy, I didn't go over too well.
Swing and a miss.
Yeah, I struck out. For the first couple of years, my mother denied the fact that I actually had converted. And then when she would talk about it, she would talk about the cult I had joined.
You're kidding.
No.
Oh, my goodness.
So, but once the Episcopal Church far exceeded my lowest expectations, then they started seeing that maybe I was speaking the truth. You know, prophets.
But they didn't.
A prophet is not honored in his own home. So.
No kidding. But they didn't ever come over into Orthodoxy.
No. In fact, they still go to the Episcopal Church this day, and they still complain regularly. So, you know.
And Lynn's family's okay with it, right? They're still faithful Roman Catholics?
Well, most of them fell away from the Roman Church, except her mother. Her mother still goes.
Because I know...
I think her sister is going to a Roman...
They come visit sometimes here, and they come
to church. Yeah, they're good sports, and they put up with the smoke and the chanting and all that. You know, and the long service.
That's funny. Well, let me ask you a question, and I didn't prep you on this right before, but we talked about this one time in the past. What would you say has been the biggest change in your life? In other words, how has Orthodoxy affected you? How has becoming Orthodox? And you've been Orthodox a long time, but what would you say one or two of the main things that have, and the main ways in which Orthodoxy has benefited you?
Oh, okay. It's the sense, a real tangible sense of connectedness to the ancient church. In fact, I went to Syria this summer, and it overwhelmed me there. We were at Basra and Haram, and we were in a town called Sweda, and that's where Metropolitan Saba, that's where his cathedral is. And we were at the cathedral, and I mean, literally like that evening, we got off the plane, we were doing Vespers, and they wanted us to do whatever we could do in English, and they would answer back in Arabic and Greek, and they just wanted to hear what our English sounded like, because they'd not heard anything done in English before.
Mm-hmm.
And they were amazed, stunned, and very inviting, and they were very excited that converts had come to Syria. They'd heard of that. In fact, they would all say this: "We've heard about converts, we've not seen any." And so they just picked our brains clean. But I had a real emotional experience in that when we celebrated the following day, we celebrated the leave taking of Pascha. I was given a white set of vestments, beautiful vestments, and they all matched with all the other priests. We did this huge hierarchical liturgy. There were people everywhere, and it was time to receive communion, and I thought, oh my goodness, I am receiving communion in this ancient community, because this community has been there for almost 2,000 years, who were first called Christians, and now I get to receive Christ with the people who did first receive Christ. And that overwhelmed me, that sense of connectedness and how much we were, I mean, as far as they were concerned, we were their brothers and sisters. You just didn't talk right. And, I mean, it was great.
It's funny.
You know, and they treated us like brothers and sisters. And so every single service we did, you know, they were inviting us to serve and celebrate. They wanted us to. In fact, we went to a monastery once and... they said, the next day, you're going to do Orthros for us. Mm. I was like, holy cow.
Wow.
I was doing everything in English, and they were doing everything in Arabic. And didn't miss a beat. It was just wonderful. And they were just most kind and most lovely people. And I got to pray in some of these most ancient sites. The thing, you know, I got to see St. Thankless Tomb and Molula. I got to go to Sednaya and see where Justinian had a vision about building a monastery. Mm-hmm. I mean, and these are ancient places, and the myrrh that you could smell, it was unbelievable. So things I have read about, I got to see, experience, touch, taste.
And I remember you saying you actually walked right down the street called Straight.
Oh yeah, twice.
Just like St. Paul.
Twice.
Yeah.
You know, and then
except you weren't blinded, at least.
No. Well, it was very hot and very, very sunny.
Felt like it.
Yeah. And then we went to the chapel where St. Paul was baptized, which is right off the street.
That's
named Straight.
That is incredible.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and then we went to Damascus and went to the bazaar, and you know.
And you took pictures there.
Oh yeah, we got to see where they think St. John's tomb is, which is now a huge mosque. When you go to this huge mosque, you can tell where the church used to be, and the way the locals tell the story is that for about 80 to 100 years, when the Muslims showed up, they would do their services in the back of the church, and the church would, near the altar, of course, do their service, and they shared the same space. And at about the 80 or 100 year mark, that's when the Muslims said, now the reasons the Muslims wanted to be there is they knew a prophet was buried nearby, mm-hmm. which was St. John's, St. John the Baptist. And so...
Oh, St. John the Baptist?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought you meant St. John of Damascus.
No. This is...
Okay.
So John the Baptist is supposed to be buried there, and...
I did not know that he was buried in Damascus.
Yeah, and so... So that's when then the Muslims said, after about 80 to 100 years, we think you'd be happier somewhere else. So they kicked the Christians out. And then they built this massive mosque that extends off of the original church. You can still see the original walls. And then right off to the side is this huge shrine for Saint John the Baptist. And the Muslims line up around the block to stand there and say their prayers at his tomb.
That is fascinating.
Yeah, it was wild. You know,
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So one of the biggest benefits, I guess, of Orthodoxy for you is that sense of connectedness to the early church and the saints.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
You know, you're not alone. You're worshiping with
people. The same things they did, and so we're being authentic, real, true Christians. We're not trying to reinvent the wheel and do clown ministry and then do rage services and guitar masses or
not trying to be relevant and seeker friendly and all.
You're so relevant you're no longer Christian. You're more of the world than something different. And so that sense of sacred, that sense of that tangible connectedness to the real ancient church, which never went away. We saw congregations that were worshiping in new buildings that were built in the 8th century. That was new for them because the old one fell down.
Right,
that was built in the 1st century. And it's like... And these people, for them, that's like, that's normal.
Right.
I remember we went to one site when we were in Syria. It was kind of funny. We had a monk priest that was taking us around. And we were in this amphitheater, 2nd century amphitheater, and all of a sudden he goes, they should tear this down over here. It's brand new. We're looking at it, it's like, it looks
brand
pretty old to us. He goes, no, it's new. This is 2nd century. He said, so we asked him, we said, so what's wrong with that? And he goes, that's 12th century. It's brand new. They should tear it down.
It's too new.
That's funny.
Well, that's interesting. Now, if I can ask, we've got a little bit more time. Mm-hmm. I want to ask you, this is something that we don't often ask people on journeys because we don't always get a priest. But tell me about your ministry here at St. Joseph. What are maybe one or two of the greatest struggles you've faced? And I know you can't go into a lot of detail in some cases, but maybe what's one or two of your greatest struggles? And then what are some of the greatest blessings you've had?
Hmm.
And you can take it in either order if you want.
Okay.
We got maybe 10 minutes.
Okay. Mundane stuff like paying the bills when you're a mission, that's really scary. When every dime that you collect on Sunday leaves on Monday.
Oh, no.
That's kind of scary.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, that's a mundane thing, but it's there. The other thing is our back door is as big as our front door. Houston is a transient place to live. People live and work here for 5 to 10 years, and then they move. So keeping that sense of community and family is kind of a struggle. I always say this, is that every family that started with us, if they were here today, this church here would be too small. We'd be starting another mission.
We've had so many good, solid families come through and then move because of their job.
I figure some other church owes us, so they can pray for us.
That's funny.
And that's probably one of the benefits is meeting the people. I get to do a year-long catechism program, which once it ends, it immediately begins, and I think that's a good way to incorporate people, and it's you get to know people, they get to know us and as a community and me personally, and I get to have some real exposure with folks, and that's kind of and that's good. And I've been able to watch this small mission of 17 families growing to about 95 now, 98. Mm-hmm. I can't remember what it is.
Yeah, and if I can break in and tell the listeners that I don't know too many parishes that have this, but we have had pretty much around the year nonstop catechumen class, at least since 2001 when we came, because it hadn't stopped, you know, except for occasional, a week or two here and there, but it's not just, and we've had catechumens. I mean, sometimes right, we've been down to three or four, but we've always had, we've always had at least three or four, and sometimes as many as 20, 25 catechumens at one time.
Yeah, the other thing about, you know, a good thing, or is that I have never been as, you know, I've never been this happy in a church setting in my life. It's fun. We do a lot of fun things. We act silly, but we also get to do some pretty pretty amazing things. I mean, I like to tell people this is you know, using the Disneyland metaphor, this is the best e-ticket ride you'll ever get. and I've enjoyed it. I've met some just amazing people: monks, nuns, lay people, bishops, metropolitans, the patriarch, and you know, who would have thought that? I'm just this goofy little guy from Houston, Texas.
Well, not exactly.
And so it's just, okay. And I've really enjoyed. Really enjoyed that. And I get to serve God while I do that, and hopefully I do it in His, you know, fulfill His will, not mine. And that's always kind of fun.
All right, Father. Well, anything? I can't speak. Any concluding words? Closing statement?
Yeah, pray for us. You know, we all need prayers, and we certainly do here in Houston. And Saint Joseph is our intercessor. And when we received that name, I thought, well, this is great. He's probably doesn't have a lot of Orthodox people calling him, because there aren't very many Saint Joseph the Betrothed churches out there.
Right.
So we kind of have him on speed dial. So, and he's worked out. He's worked real well for us.
That's true.
You know, every time we make a call to him, boom, things happen. So
that's right. Well, all right. So if anybody is ever going to be in the Houston area, we invite you to come visit us at St. Joseph's. We have several excellent parishes in the city, so it's not like we're the place, the only good place to go.
Yeah, we're one of the congregations at St. George in Houston. The Mama Church started. We're one of four.
Yeah.
One, two, three, four. Yeah, four.
That's a great parish too. They've sent out missions and started missions, and now they're still busting at the seams.
Yeah, they are.
Well, all right, Father, could you give us a blessing to conclude?
Oh, a blessing.
Yes,
sure.
An old Irish blessing. I didn't have to be that.
The Lord God bless us and keep us and make His face shine upon us and grant us His mercy. Amen.
Thank you, Father.
All right, thank you.
This has been Father James Early interviewing Father Matthew McKay, coming at you from Houston on the Orthodox Christian Network. God bless.
Thank you for listening to Journeys to Orthodoxy, a production of the Icon New Media Network, where Orthodox Christianity is the future of American spirituality. Would you like to share your journey with us? Please do so by contacting us at journeys@iconnewmedianetwork.com. Journeys to Orthodoxy can be heard on the Orthodox Christian Network at www.myocn.net.